One quick update. We mentioned Keith Rudolph, and I received a text a few minutes ago that obviously he's at Lures. We mentioned that, but they have determined he has pneumonia, and so he's going to be there for a few days. So please keep him, continue to keep him in your prayers. Martin Reinkert was a preacher in Germany in the 1600s, and he preached during what was known as the 30 Years' War. And the city in which he lived was named Eilenburg. And that particular city became something of a city of refuge during the war. But the issue became that because of that, so many people poured into the city of Eilenburg that it began to overwhelm the city. Things like famine began to spread, disease began to spread, and became a very dangerous place, to the point that in just 1 year in the 1660s, Martin Reinkert himself personally conducted 4,000 funerals, doing as many at least once as 50 in a single day. As if that wasn't tragic enough, one of those was his own wife, with whom they already had children. And because it was famine situations and economic ruin, it wasn't like he was making a lot of money doing all these funerals, and so he was trying to put food on the table and could barely do it. And it wasn't after that situation had passed. It was right in the middle of it that Martin Reinkert composed a poem that was later set to music. And in fact, the famous composer Felix Mendelssohn actually wrote the harmony for it. I don't believe I've ever sung it, but I've seen the poem many times. And keep in mind that setting when you listen to what he wrote. "Now thank we all our God with hearts and hands and voices, who wondrous things has done, in whom this world rejoices, who from our mother's arms has blessed us on our way with countless gifts of love and still is ours today. All praise and thanks to God the Father now be given, the Son and Him who reigns with them in highest heaven, the one eternal God whom earth and heaven adore, for thus it was, is now, and shall be evermore." How do you do that? How do you write a poem like that in the midst of that kind of suffering and difficulty? There are a lot of places we could go to in the Bible to illustrate that kind of mindset. But I want to go back to that passage that we read earlier. I appreciate Dwayne reading that passage. When he mentioned Habakkuk, you may have said, "I give up, I'm not finding it." But even if you need to use your table of contents, I want you to find the book of Habakkuk this morning. Because the ending of this book is one of those places that may not be as familiar to most of us, but it is a powerful statement by this prophet of the same kind of mindset of dealing with a difficult circumstance. If you're not familiar with the book of Habakkuk, this is meant to be a very, very brief and simplistic overview. But let me tell you how we get to those last few verses. The book begins with Habakkuk basically asking God, "Do you see how morally wrong your people are? Do you see how bad things have actually gotten?" And God tells the prophet, I know that, and I'm going to do something about it, but you won't believe it when I tell you what it is. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the Chaldeans to take over Judah." And hearing that, Habakkuk, well, he doesn't believe it. Because he basically looks back at God and says, "The Chaldeans, they're worse than we are." To which God says, "I know, and they're going to get what's coming to them too. But they're going to be my instruments first to take care of the sin of my people." And Habakkuk spends a lot of this book wrestling with that. In fact, you quoted Habakkuk this morning whether you knew it or not. Because when Gary was sitting up here and began to sing, "The Lord is in His holy temple," that's Habakkuk 2 verse 20. You got a memory verse this morning. Just put the word "but" at the beginning of it, because Habakkuk said, "But the Lord," and you got it. You got a memory verse this morning. But Habakkuk wrestles with this concept of how can God work in those ways using a more wicked nation to take care of His own people's sins and all these things. And when he gets to Habakkuk chapter 3, he's remembering some things God has done in the past, but he's still wrestling with it. He can't quite get it. And I love the humanity of it, where this prophet who can't quite get the how or the when or anything else still ends the way he does. In fact, in the final verse before we read earlier, in Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 16, look at what he says. He says, "I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. It's because of that verse, by the way, that I nicknamed the book of Habakkuk from questioning confusion to quiet confidence. Because he still doesn't get it, but he trusts in God. And what he does in the final verses that finish out this book is he shows us how to deal with it when giving thanks is difficult. Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday because it's Christmas without the pressure. But we love those songs, well, to teach us about counting our blessings and naming them one by one. But let's call it like it is. There are seasons of life and circumstances of life when making that list is harder than other times. So how do we have things like gratitude and joy and praise, even in times where things are difficult? I want to look at the last three verses of Habakkuk chapter 3 and make three observations. First of all, in this text, there is the crushing reality. What Habakkuk does in verse 17 is he uses the agricultural language of the world in which he lived. You may live in a different world. We know something about agriculture. You may live more in a factory world or an investing world or a teaching world or an office world or something. But no matter what kind of world you live in, you can still get the picture that Habakkuk uses in verse 17, where he uses all this agricultural language to show what was going on or what was going to happen. There are a few scholars who believe that the way Habakkuk writes this may hint at the fact that some of these things he writes about were already beginning to happen. It seems more likely to me that what he is saying is when the Chaldeans come, when this foreign invading army comes, this is what it's going to be like. Because of the simple things of war, because they're going to forage the land and all these things. And what he paints is an absolutely bleak picture. Because did you notice he talks about how there are things that should be producing, but they're not. They're still fig trees, but they're not blossoming. There's still vines, but there's no grapes. There's still barns and stalls, but there's no animals to put in. It's a picture of just economic, agricultural devastation. And what he does in using that language is paint a picture. Now, these overlap a little bit, but you put together what he describes in these verses, and he's making it very clear how this is going to feel. He uses words that talk about things like loss. There are no blossoms. There are no grapes. There's a loss here economically. There's a loss here agriculturally. There's a loss here of their own safety and all sorts of things. He uses terminology that speaks of lacking certain things. Oh, you got fields out there, but nothing's growing in them. There's just a lack of what you would need to survive and to have an economy and all these sorts of things. He uses words and pictures and talk about it being lean. We still use that terminology. You may talk to someone who's a farmer and they say it's a lean year for corn or wheat or whatever it happens to be. And what they mean is, yeah, the fields are still out there, but it's not doing what they're supposed to do. What Habakkuk describes is leanness in the extreme because the fields are producing nothing. There's nothing growing. And you put all of those things together and it's a picture of absolute lifelessness because you don't have anything that would truly sustain life. And because of that, the situation seems hopeless. You look at a culture that's based on agriculture, and you don't have anything like olives or figs or grapes or animals or fields. I'm no economic expert, but that seems like deep trouble to me. That seems like complete hopelessness. And Habakkuk is not afraid to say that is the situation, or that's what the situation will be when the Chaldeans come. That's what it's going to be like. You or I may not completely connect with the agricultural picture. You may. But can you not connect with the feelings of what Habakkuk is describing? When you're going through a time of loss, whether that's losing someone you love or a loss of a relationship or whatever it happens to be, maybe it's a financial loss or a job loss or you lack something. There's just something in your life, not sinful, but just something that's making life where you're lacking peace or joy or whatever it happens to be, or it's just a lean time economically, even spiritually. And what all those things lead to is a sense of lifelessness. How many times have you heard someone say, or maybe you said it yourself, I could barely get out of bed this morning. It was almost impossible to put one foot in front of the other. I had to do everything I could do to get to work or to school, even, dare I say it, church. You're just not yourself. And the question becomes, how are you supposed to give thanks and praise and have joy in that? That's number two, the chosen resolve. Because the answer is, you choose to. In verse 17, Habakkuk gives that description. It is very clear-eyed. This is exactly the way it's going to be. Again, maybe using a little bit of word picture or poetry, but he makes it clear. This is the way it's going to be. Yet, I will. And then he says two of those words again. I will. How do you have joy or thanks or praise when it, very clear-eyed, you know, things are difficult or things are about to be difficult? You choose to. You choose to. Habakkuk speaks of God. We'll get to some of the descriptions in a few moments of how he describes Him. But it's interesting to me that when you go through Scripture, you can find others who did much the same thing. You think of many of the Psalms. We could read a bunch this morning if we wanted to. But just think in your mind of how many of those poems that David, especially that David wrote, we wrote about half the Psalms, how many of them begin in a state of desperation? Sometimes directed at God. Oh Lord, will you forget me forever? Sometimes directed at situations in which David found himself with enemies. I was hemmed in. My enemies were all around me. All these terms. Here was David writing poetry describing the situation itself, but also how it made him feel. He wasn't ashamed to say, I'm scared, I'm afraid, I'm frustrated, I'm mad, all these different things. You think of Nehemiah. In the opening chapter of that book, he's not in the city of Jerusalem, but he gets a report. The walls of Jerusalem have been broken down, the gates are burned, and the vast majority of the remainder of Nehemiah chapter 1 is him praying to God and basically saying, this is what the situation is, and this is how I feel about it. We are a derision. Look at what's happened because of this. He doesn't just give a cold listing of the facts. He's not ashamed to say, God, this is the situation, and this is how I feel about it. You think about Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, that thorn in the flesh. No, I don't know what it was either. But I do know that it's some kind of physical difficulty because he talks about how it was in his body. It was a messenger sent from Satan to buffet him, to cause him to be humble, those sorts of things. It's awful. And while we don't have the text of the prayer, he specifically says, I pleaded with God. Three times it should be taken away. So he's not ashamed to say, here's the situation, but also here's how I feel about it. But then you begin to look at their reaction to them. And they do exactly what Habakkuk does in Habakkuk chapter. Because how many times in those Psalms when David begins by talking about how he feels and how dangerous the situation is, how terrified he is, how often when you get near or at the end of those poems does David either say something like, I will trust in God, or God has been good to me. In other words, yes, the situation is still dangerous and difficult and frightening and confusing, but I'm choosing to remember who I serve. You think about Nehemiah. The situation didn't change. The walls were still broken down. The gates were still burned. Nehemiah was still many, many miles away. But when you get to chapter 2 of Nehemiah, an opportunity arises. And the king asks him, why do you look sad? You don't usually look sad. And Nehemiah is ready with the response. Here's why. Because of what's happening to my people in my home city. He has chosen to remain faithful to the plan of God, even though his mind is back home with that difficulty. You think about Paul with that thorn in the flesh. He didn't like it. He wanted it taken away. He pled for it to be taken away. But when he was told specifically and directly, this is not going to be taken away, Paul says, then I'll boast in my infirmities. Because when I'm weak, then I'm strong. I'm going to choose to, in the middle of this difficulty, use it to glorify God. And that's exactly what Habakkuk does in Habakkuk 3:18. Even if all of these economic things fall apart, even if my little world and the world itself is in utter turmoil, I will choose. I will be resolved to have joy in God. And the reason is, the only thing to take away things like gratitude and joy is our own decision. What Habakkuk reminds us is that gratitude is not a matter of the harvest. Gratitude is a matter of the heart. The story is told of a little boy who was walking home. Now, this is a terrible picture because it should be chocolate ice cream. He's a good kid. But the story is told of a little boy who was walking home one day with an ice cream cone and just licking it and smiling from ear to ear. And his shoe caught a crack in the sidewalk and he slipped just a little bit. But if you ever had that happen, you know what's about to happen. You don't have to slip much, because what happens is that ice cream falls off, hits your hand, hits the sidewalk, and in the heat of the summer melted away. What I didn't tell you was about three steps behind him was his dad, who had bought the ice cream cone. And his dad ran up to him, took those couple steps, and picked up his son. And the son kept crying because this was his ice cream cone. And his son was still disappointed. But something changed because the dad had picked him up and held him in his arms. Here's the moral of that story. Happiness is the ice cream cone. It's sweet, but it comes and it goes. Gratitude and joy are the Father's arms, because they're always there. And they're always present if we'll let them surround us. That's exactly what Habakkuk begins to realize when he goes into this concept of, I don't understand everything you're saying, God. I know what you've told me, and I know how difficult this looks like it's going to be, but I am choosing to be a person of joy and gratitude. But how could he do that? It's not all about, well, I'm just going to pull myself up by my own bootstraps. No, that's number three. He grounds it in God, who is the certain resource. If you read the rest of Habakkuk chapter 3, everything else is said except for a notation at the end that tells us that the Israelites, or the Jews, excuse me, were supposed to sing this to the choir master with stringed instruments. Everything else in this centers on Habakkuk's relationship with God. And what he does is he gives four lines that describe for us things about God that were the reason why he could make the resolution and choose to be a person of thanks and joy. He lists four things. First is God's salvation. Now, the first couple of things in that list seem somewhat familiar to a sermon I preached just a couple of weeks ago, because this theme runs throughout the Old Testament many, many times. But here, Habakkuk says, I'll rejoice in the God of my salvation. And you may recall a couple of weeks ago, he mentioned that, especially in the Old Testament, the word salvation also can mean deliverance. Habakkuk is not saying that God's going to deliver me from this situation with the Chaldeans that are coming in. God has said, that's what's going to happen. They are coming, this is the way it's going to be, and then it's what's coming to them. But what Habakkuk is saying is, this is no longer just about the people of Israel or the people of Judah and God. This is about me and God. And God is going to be my deliverance, not out of the situation, but through the situation. He's the one who's going to provide that for me in the midst of the difficulty. Then he talks about God's strength. You read through the Psalms, and you have a lot of word pictures that talk about the strength of God. We love some like this. Fortress, tower, rock. There's another one that may not sound as much strength, but it really is. In Psalm 37 and verse 2, where David said, you are a hiding place for me. That doesn't sound like strength. Yeah, it is. Because notice what Habakkuk says, my strength. Sometimes we need the strength of God that really is more like that fortress and that tower or that sword and shield and those sorts of things. And sometimes God realizes we need the strength of stepping back and hiding in Him so we can face the difficulty ahead. And the amazing thing is, God knows which we need and God provides all. Then he talks about the stability of God. You make my feet like the feet of deer. The terrain of the land in which Habakkuk lived, Judah, was quite rocky, quite not necessarily mountainous, but rocky and craggy and those sorts of things. That's part of the reason why, by the way, that the beginning of the story of the Good Samaritan works. A man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and it talks about the road being not smooth, because thieves would hide in the crags and the rocks on the road and jump out. That's what makes that story work, is people knew that road, that situation. But the deer of that region, they have hooves that are covered with a hard covering. They have a skeletal structure, muscle structure, that makes it to where handling those rocks is no big deal. They literally jump across the crags and on top of it's crazy. You and I couldn't do it. Well, you could try it, but welcome to the hospital. But the deer jump all over the place. And what Habakkuk is saying is God provides that for him. But notice he's saying by that God provides it for him in the midst of the difficulty. He doesn't say God gets me out of this. No, he makes my feet prepared to be going through this time of difficulty. He provides the stability even though things are still rocky and craggy and difficult. And then the surety of God. The surety of God. As he ends the description in verse 19 by saying, he makes me tread on high places. Notice that he makes me tread on the high places. He doesn't say he's going to remove the high places. He doesn't say God's going to change the terrain and make everything smooth and simple. No. He says there are times that God's going to make me go over those rocks, around those craggy areas, and deal with them. It's very similar to what David writes in probably the most famous psalm. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for you are with me. Does it say you take away the valley of the shadow of death? It says I've got to walk through it sometimes. But what makes it where I can go through that? You are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. That's exactly what Habakkuk is saying here. That God's not going to take away the rocks and the difficulty, but he makes me walk through them. But here's the thing. He's going to walk through them with me. You read through Scripture, you get all these pictures of God being with us, and you put all of them together, and you get a picture of God walking before us, behind us, below us, above us, and around us. He's everywhere. And it doesn't matter if the path is smooth, the path is rocky, God is right there. He is the certain resource. I can make decisions all day long that says, I'm going to choose to be joyful, or I'm going to choose to be thankful. But what am I basing those things on? I need to base those things on the God from whom all good things flow. And the God who walks with me through those difficult times. With all that in mind, go back to how we began. And think about that poem that Martin Reinker wrote. And ask yourself, as I ask myself, if I could say honestly the words, now thank we all our God, no matter when the now is. You see, it's easy to say, now I thank God, when I've got plenty of money in the bank, my marriage is healthy, when I'm feeling good, when my relationships are fine, when the people nearest to me are handling life just fine. It's just not hard to say, hashtag blessed. But what if the now is when there are no blossoms on the fig trees, no grapes on the vine, no olive in leaf, no plants in the field, no animals in the stalls. Now, can I thank God? What Habakkuk says is, yes, because I choose to remember who God is. In many ways, what Habakkuk does is summarize a couple of verses that most of us know a whole lot better. What he basically does is summarize Hebrews 13, verse 5, where God promises, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And what Peter would write when he says, cast all your cares upon him because he cares for you. That's really what Habakkuk is doing. It's putting that in living form, saying, that's the decision I'm making. And sometimes, you come to church and we sing, count your blessings. You begin to think, that's really hard right now. But do you remember one of the key words that hymn? It will surprise you. It will surprise you what the Lord has done. Brother Gary led us in the song, God is so good. It's one of the simplest songs we ever sing. It is also one of the truest songs we ever sing. Because no matter what you and I might be going through, God really is good. And I might really have to think sometimes about what am I thankful for in this circumstance or in this situation or in this season of life. But He really has been there. And He is there. And He will be there. Fanny Crosby was born in 1820. She lived until 1915. She wrote a lot of hymns. In fact, over 8,000 in her life. It's a lot of poetry. I can't rhyme that many words. We sing a lot of them still. To God be the glory, great things He has done. That's our song. Blessed assurance, Jesus is mine. I am thine, O Lord. Tell me the story of Jesus. And what some of you may know about her is she wrote all of those songs partially out of her devotion. She loved God, had faith in Him, but also because she had to. She spent most of her life going in and out of poverty. And so she wrote them as a way to make some money. Maybe that's why she wrote 8,000. What some of you also know is that as an infant, she became blind and never regained her sight. And wrote every one of those poems out of blindness. By the way, read some of the songs that talk about imagery, knowing a blind person wrote them. But at one point in her life, she was asked about that. And this is what she said. She said, "It seemed intended by the blessed providence of God that I should be blind all my life. And I thank Him for the dispensation." Put that in 2025 Western Kentucky language. I wouldn't have it any other way. Now, thank we all our God. Whatever it is you are going through, or think you might be going through, there are reasons to have joy. There are reasons to give thanks. And there are reasons to praise God. Because He is in His holy temple. Habakkuk 2, verse 21. This morning, maybe you've never given your life to Him by becoming a Christian. Maybe you see Christians go, how can they live this way? How can they deal with all this stuff? We've talked about that this morning. Because we know who we serve. And we trust Him. And maybe that's a life you want to have. Something's keeping you from that. That something is sin. The Bible simply says, you must believe in Jesus, the one that God sent. You must repent, turn from those sins. I'm going to live for God, not live for self anymore. I'm going to confess that Jesus is the Son of God. I'm going to be baptized, immersed in water, and those sins will be taken away. At that point in time, you're a Christian. Maybe this morning, as a Christian, there's something in your life that you're really struggling with. It's causing you to not have joy, not be great. And you can say this one, I need to make that decision. No matter what it is in this life, no matter what this life throws at me, God's still good. But I want to pray. I want to be encouraged. Maybe you need to come forward this morning. Maybe you need to go to the back and speak with one of our elders. But whatever your need is, will you come? Always stand and sing to encourage you.